Worths and Bradfords had known each other in Leiden, and just a few weeks after the Anne's arrival, William and Alice were married on August 14th, 1623. The festivities that followed were much more than the celebration of a marriage. A new order had come to New England, and there to commemorate the governor's nuptials was Massasoit, with a black wolf skin draped over his shoulder and, for propriety's sake, with just one of his five wives by his side. Also attending were about 120 of his warriors, about twice as many men as he had been able to muster a little more than a year ago, who danced with such a noise, one witness reported, that you would wonder. As Indians on Cape Cod to the east and in Massachusetts to the north continued to be gripped by fear and confusion, a supreme confidence had come to the Poconokets. Massasoit was now firmly in control, and it had been Standish's assault at Wessagusset that had made it possible. Serving as a grim reminder of the fearful power of the Poconoket Pilgrim Alliance was the flesh-blackened skull of Wituamat, still planted on a pole above the fort roof. It was only appropriate that a new flag be raised for Massasoit's benefit. Instead of the Standard of England and its red St. George's cross, the pilgrims unfurled a blood-soaked piece of linen. It was the same cloth that had once swaddled Wituamat's head, and it now flew bravely above the fort, a reddish-brown smear against the blue summer sky. Part 3. Community. Chapter 10. One Small Candle. Up until 1630, Plymouth was the only significant English settlement in the region. That year, an armada of 17 ships arrived off the New England coast. In a matter of months, approximately 1,000 English men, women, and children, more than three times the entire population of Plymouth, had been delivered to the vicinity of Boston. In the years ahead, the Puritan colony of Massachusetts Bay grew to include modern New Hampshire and Maine, while other Puritan settlers headed south to found Connecticut. Adding to the mix was the Massachusetts exile Roger Williams, who in 1636 founded what became the religiously tolerant colony of Rhode Island, a haven for Baptists, Quakers, and other non-Puritans. With Plymouth serving as the great original, New England had become exactly what its name suggested, a new England composed of autonomous colonies. But for William Bradford, who had come to America to recreate the community of fellow worshippers he had known in Scrooby and in Leiden, there would always be something missing. In 1625, Bradford received the stunning news that the congregation's minister, John Robinson, had died in Leiden. Robinson was irreplaceable, and a profound sense of sadness and inadequacy settled over the Plymouth Church. For all they had suffered during those first terrible winters in America, their best years were behind them in Leiden. Never again would they know that same rapturous sense of divine fellowship that had first launched them on this quest. Elder William Brewster soldiered on as their spiritual leader, but the Plymouth congregation never warmed to another minister throughout the first half of the century. Without Robinson, the pilgrims could not help but fear that their original purpose in coming to America was in constant danger of being subverted, if not entirely destroyed. As a consequence, the passion and fervor that had enabled them to survive those first grim years threatened to darken into a mean-spirited fanaticism. Even before Robinson's death, John Lyford, a minister sent over by the merchant adventurers, was cast out of the settlement for secretly meeting with disgruntled settlers who wished to worship as they had back in England. One of Lyford's supporters, John Oldham, was forced to run through a gauntlet of musket-wielding pilgrims who beat him with the butt ends of their weapons. When Edward Winslow, just back from a voyage to England, arrived on the scene, he urged his comrades not to spare Oldham. In his correspondence and his history of the colony, Bradford did his best to claim that Lyford and Oldham richly deserved their punishments. The merchant adventurers, however, remained unconvinced and chastised the pilgrims for being contentious, cruel, and hard-hearted among your neighbors, and towards such as in all points, both civil and religious, jump not with you. In the years just before and after Robinson's death, Plymouth lost approximately a quarter of its residents as disaffected strangers either returned to England or moved to Virginia. Some, such as Oldham and a salter named Roger Conant, found refuge amid the isolated fishing and trading outposts that had sprouted up along the New England coast at places like Nantasket and Cape Ann. We can only wonder how different the early years of Plymouth might have been if Robinson had made it to the New World. If his letters to Bradford and the others are any indication, he might have insisted on a policy of moderation and restraint, not only with the Indians, but also with the strangers in the settlement. Despite Robinson's warnings about Miles Standish, Bradford continued to depend on his military officer to push forward the often brutal agenda of what was becoming the Pilgrim Way in New England. About the same time as Robinson's passing, a new settlement was started just to the north of Wissagusset in modern Braintree. The settlement's founder was, according to Bradford, a man of pretty parts, who quickly decided to relocate to Virginia. One of his fellow investors, a jolly, down-on-his-luck lawyer from London named Thomas Morton, opted to remain in New England with a handful of servants, and Morton subsequently dubbed the new venture Merrymount. As the name of his settlement might suggest, Morton represented everything the Pilgrims had come to America to escape. In addition to being, in Bradford's words, a pettifogger of more craft than honesty, Morton was an Anglican who enjoyed reading the Greek and Latin classics and composing his own ribald verse. For Morton, a Sunday was best spent not in prayer, but in hunting with his falcon, or, better yet, sharing a drink with the local Indians. Instead of building a wall around Merrymount, Morton erected an 80-foot-high maypole, a gleeful and decidedly pagan proclamation that God was not to be taken overly seriously, at least in Morton's neck of New England. Lubricated by plenty of alcohol, he and his men danced around the maypole with their native neighbors, making a mockery of the solemn exclusivity of the Plymouth settlement. What was worse, Morton's intimacy with the Indians quickly made him the favored trading partner in the region. He even dared to equip them with guns, since this enabled the Indians to procure more furs. The Pilgrims had come face to face with a figure from a future America, the frontiersman, who happily thumbed his nose at authority while embracing the wilderness. One of Plymouth's residents, Richard and Elizabeth Warren's 10-year-old daughter Elizabeth, would one day give birth to a son named Benjamin Church, who would have a decidedly Morton-like love of the wilderness and play a significant role in the emerging American frontier. But that was decades in the future. For now, the Pilgrims had no use for anyone who dared to favor the heathen over the godly. Bradford decided to send Standish on yet another raid to the north, not to kill any Indians, but to seize this Lord of Misrule. Morton quickly discovered what the Pilgrims had become in the years since Wissagusset. He had already learned from the Massachusetts Indians of the viciousness of Standish's earlier attack and the fear it had unleashed in the region. After being taken by Standish and his men, who fell upon him as if they would have eaten him, Morton began to question who were now the true savages in this land. "But I have found the Massachusetts Indians more full of humanity than the Christians," he wrote, "and have had much better quarter with them." Morton wasn't the only Englishman to be astonished by the vindictiveness of the Pilgrims. In 1625, the former Plymouth resident Roger Conant was forced to intercede in an altercation between Standish and some fishermen on Cape Ann. Conant was so appalled by the violence of the Plymouth captain's manner that he later described the incident in great detail to the Puritan historian William Hubbard. Echoing Robinson's earlier concerns, Hubbard wrote, "Captain Standish never entered the school of our Savior Christ, or, if he was ever there, had forgot his first lessons, to offer violence to no man." As Morton and Pecksuot had observed, it was almost comical to see this sort of fury in a soldier who had been forced to shorten his rapier by 6 inches, Otherwise, the tip of his sword's scabbard would have dragged along the ground when he slung it from his waist. "A little chimney is soon fired," Hubbard wrote. So was the Plymouth captain, a man of very little stature, yet of a very hot and angry temper. In 1624, Holland purchased Manhattan from the Indians and established the colony of New Netherland. Since many of the Pilgrims knew the language, it was perhaps inevitable that Plymouth established a strong relationship with the Dutch colony. In 1627, the Dutch trading agent, Isaac de Rassier, visited Plymouth, and his description of the English community on a typical Sunday provides fascinating evidence of just how strong Standish's influence continued to be. "They assembled by beat of drum, each with his musket or firelock, in front of the captain's door. They have their cloaks on, and place themselves in order, three abreast, and are led by a sergeant without beat of drum. Behind comes the governor in a long robe. Beside him on the right hand comes the preacher with his cloak on, and on the left hand the captain with his sidearms and cloak on, and with a small cane in his hand. And so they march in good order, and each sets his arms down near him. Thus they are constantly on their guard night and day." 7 years after the Mayflower had sailed, Plymouth Plantation was still an armed fortress where each male communicant worshipped with a gun at his side. The fall of 1623 marked the end of Plymouth's debilitating food shortages. For the last two planting seasons, the Pilgrims had grown crops communally, the approach first used at Jamestown and other English settlements. But as the disastrous harvest of the previous fall had shown, something drastic needed to be done to increase the annual yield. In April, Bradford had decided that each household should be assigned its own plot to cultivate, with the understanding that each family kept whatever it grew. The change in attitude was stunning. Families were now willing to work much harder than they had ever worked before. In previous years, the men had tended the fields while the women tended the children at home. "The women now went willingly into the field," Bradford wrote, "and took the little ones with them to set corn." The Pilgrims had stumbled on the power of capitalism. Although the fortunes of the colony still teetered precariously in the years ahead, the inhabitants never again starved. By 1623, the Pilgrims had goats, pigs, and chickens. That year, Winslow sailed for England and returned with some cows. Soon to follow were more cattle and some horses. Despite Winslow's claim that Plymouth was a place where religion and profit jumped together, the colony was unable to achieve any sort of long-term financial success. By 1626, the merchant adventurers in London had disbanded, and Bradford and seven others, including Winslow, Brewster, Standish, Alden, Howland, Ullerton, and Thomas Prince, who had come over in the Fortune in 1621, agreed to assume the colony's debt with the understanding that they'd be given a monopoly in the fur trade. The following year, the Dutch trading agent Isaac de Rassier introduced the Pilgrims to wampum, the white and purple shell beads that quickly became the medium of exchange in New England and revolutionized the trade with the Indians. By the early 1630s, Plymouth had established a series of trading posts that extended all the way from the Connecticut River to Castine, Maine. After it was started under the direction of the veteran frontiersman Edward Ashley, the trading post in Castine was run by the young Thomas Willett, who arrived in Plymouth in 1629 as a 22-year-old émigré from Leiden. John Howland and John Alden established a second Pilgrim trading post in Maine on the Kennebec River at modern Augusta. By this time, Howland had married Mayflower passenger Elizabeth Tilley, while Alden had married Priscilla Mullins. In 1634, the Plymouth men at Kennebec got into a fatal argument with some rival English fur traders that resulted in Alden being briefly detained in a Boston jail. The following year, the French forced Willett and his men to abandon their post in Castine. For Howland, Alden, and especially Willett, who eventually became one of the wealthiest men in the colony, Maine provided a valuable education in the rough-and-tumble world of international trade in the New World. Despite some remarkable early returns in the fur trade, Bradford and his fellow investors struggled to pay off the colony's debt. Bradford blamed most of their difficulties on his former assistant governor, Isaac Allerton. Allerton, who had mercantile ambitions of his own, was entrusted with overseeing Plymouth's relations with the merchants in England, and it eventually became apparent that Allerton was mixing his personal business with the colonies. As a result of his mismanagement, if not outright fraud, Plymouth's debts only increased, even though the Pilgrims had sent significant quantities of furs back to England. In truth, it was not all Isaac Allerton's fault. Bradford, who'd suffered reversals of his own back in Leiden, never had a talent for financial matters, and the colony continued to have trouble with the merchants in London long after Allerton ceased representing them in 1630. According to Bradford's calculations, between 1631 and 1636, they shipped £10,000 sterling in beaver and otter pelts, worth almost $2 million in today's dollars, yet saw no significant reduction in their debt of approximately £6,000 sterling. Not only were the Pilgrims poor judges of character, they were forced to struggle with the logistical difficulties of sending goods back and forth across 3,000 miles of ocean. Plymouth was an inadequate port to begin with, and financial stability only came to the colony when their principal market shifted from London to Boston, which later emerged as New England's primary port. Not until 1648, after they had been forced to sell off some of their own land, did Bradford and the other Plymouth investors finally settle their accounts with the merchants in England. It would be left to others to hit upon a way to wealth in the New World. As Pastor Robinson had suggested, the Pilgrims had lost more than a little of their collective soul at Wissagusset, but so had the Poconokets. Massasoit had entered into a devil's bargain with the English. By selling out his native neighbors in Massachusetts and Cape Cod, he had cast his lot with a culture and technology on which his own people increasingly came to depend. Whether it was iron hoes and kettles, blankets, liquor, or guns, the English had what the Poconokets wanted. There would be some good years ahead, as the Pilgrims eagerly traded with them for furs, but as the beavers and the other fur-bearing animals grew scarce, the only thing the Indians had to sell to the English was their land. It had begun innocently enough in 1621, when Massasoit had given Patuxet to the Pilgrims as a gift. Back then, it had been difficult to imagine a time when land would be anything but a boundless resource. The Pilgrims believed that since no Indians were presently living on the land, it was legally theirs. "It is lawful now to take a land which none useth," Robert Cushman wrote, "and make use of it." By the 1630s, however, the Pilgrims had begun to take a different view, a change in attitude that may have been in response to the radical beliefs of a new minister. Roger Williams had already upset the authorities in Massachusetts Bay by the time he moved from Boston to Plymouth in 1633. In addition to what Bradford described as some strange opinions regarding spiritual matters, Williams insisted that the Indians were the legal owners of their lands. If the English were to take title, Williams argued, they must first purchase the land from its previous owners. Williams's unusual religious convictions soon got him into trouble in Plymouth, forcing him to move back to Massachusetts Bay. By 1635, his unsettled judgment resulted in his banishment from the colony, and he soon after founded Rhode Island. Despite the brief and tumultuous nature of Williams's time in Plymouth, he appears to have had a lasting influence on the colony. Soon after his departure, the Pilgrims began recording their purchases of Indian land. It's true that the English concept of land ownership was initially unfamiliar to the Indians. Instead of a title and deed, the Indians' relationship to the land was based on a complex mixture of cultural factors, with the sachem possessing the right to distribute land in his own territory. But whatever misunderstandings existed in the beginning between the Indians and the English, By the second decade of Plymouth